Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the campaign trail, there's a lot of talk about big change in America, but Jim Hightower, best-selling Texas rabble-rouser and high-humored critic of corporate power, thinks we should be talking about change at every level, right down to the small stuff. He's calling on Americans to get a little rebellious and take back business, politics, and regular life from the powers that be. Hightower has just issued a new manifesto, and he's here to share it. Get your pitchfork. This hour on Point, Jim Hightower says, get rowdy. And joining me in the studio is Jim Hightower, political writer, humorist, former Texas politician, now high-spirited pundit. His last book, Thieves in High Places, was a New York Times bestseller. He was twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner, serving from 1983 to 91, when he was beaten by a candidate backed by Karl Rove. Since then, he's been barnstorming the country with a populist, progressive message. His new book, co-authored with Susan DeMarco, and out this week, is Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. The late columnist Molly Ivins, to whom his new book is dedicated, said, if Will Rogers and Mother Jones had a baby, Jim Hightower would be that rambunctious child, mad as hell with a sense of humor. Jim Hightower, welcome to On
Point.
Great
to be with you, Tom, and all the listeners across the country.
Well, welcome. How's it going down there in Texas? Have you started your brush fire revolution, or are you still camped out in a bunker somewhere?
Well, we just finished our primary and our caucuses. You know, in Texas, we get to vote twice.
Yes, we know. Once legal. In the daytime and one in the moonlight.
That's the way it goes. We were about as confused as goats on AstroTurf. We didn't really know what we were doing, but it worked out beautifully. And part of, you know, that you were talking about change earlier in your conversation and what was going on. Dramatic turnout. I did go to my caucus. It was a precinct that had 16 people in 2004. They had more than 400 this time. We were meeting in a big Baptist church across the street from a bar, of
course.
This
is in Austin.
In Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And this time, we couldn't fit in the church. We had to go out in the parking lot and divide up.
So a lot of excitement out there. But look at your state. It's a big state. Look at it big picture. Is Texas still George W. Bush country or something else?
It's something else. It's what it has always been, which is a state of working stiffs and small business people and dirt farmers and poor people. Texas did not turn right-wing. It didn't even turn Republican. What it turned was a non-voting state because the Democrats quit being Democrats. And as a result, we've had a precipitous decline in voter turnout in previous years. For example, in 98, when Bush was running for re-election and won, we had a 26% voter turnout, the lowest in the country, making him the choice of about 14% of the people of Texas. So this time it's different. The Democrats are now contesting with good candidates, not only at the presidential level, but at other levels as well. So I think Texas will be in play in November.
Really, when we look at that big map on that November night, on that November Tuesday, you can imagine Texas in the Democratic Party category?
It is possibly. We say out in Lubbock.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and change is the big theme this year. You've been hollering about change for years, but are you hearing from the candidates on the campaign trail, you name it, from McCain or Clinton or Obama, are you hearing the change you're talking about, or is it something else? Is it just a word?
I'm hearing elements of it. I don't hear change necessarily in all the policies, certainly not from McCain. Some from Clinton and some from Obama. But what I'm hearing are the people being very serious about it. You know, they voted for change in 2006. We sent some new rabble-rousers to the U.S. Senate, for example. Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, John Tester, Sherrod Brown, Claire McCaskill. Mm-hmm. Big change. Yet the leadership, they don't have the numbers yet inside the Democratic caucus in the Congress. The leadership has balked and disappointed a lot of people. Well, people could have just, you know, tucked their tail and gone away. But instead, they've come back louder than ever, demanding change this time. So, for example, the Obama phenomena, to me, the most significant thing is not Obama, but the phenomena that we've got millions of young people and new voters, people who have not been voting in a while, turning out, thinking it's possible, maybe, that change could come. And that, I think, is the most important thing that's happening politically. People begin to believe it is possible. And with that belief, they would go in into the White House themselves, certainly with an Obama, probably with a Clinton as well, to be a counterpunch to the lobbying powers that certainly will try to capture anybody's presidency.
You've got a lot of stories of change going on already at kind of a grassroots level in this new book, Swim Against the Current. We're going to hear some of those stories. But before we dive into them, we better understand sort of the Jim Hightower theory of the case. Where is it that you see the United States right now, Americans right now, the sort of mentality, the way the country's pitched, and why is it that you're hollering for the country to hearken back to its founding tradition of rebelliousness? Well, give us your theory.
Well, I think that little spirit of rebelliousness is tucked inside all of us. It's sort of innate in our genes, I guess. But it's rarely appealed to, not only in politics, but in business, in education, any other way. But people, it's surfacing in people because they've been knocked down. We've got an economy that has what I call the tinkle down economy that has benefited the few at the top, but the rest of us, we've had 90% of American people on average have lost income in the last 30 years, not just under Bush, under Democratic presidents as well. People know that. They know that our country's down the wrong path. You know, Tom, I saw it on a bumper sticker in my town of Austin a couple of years ago, an old beat-up pickup truck. That's actually redundant in Austin, but nonetheless. This bumper sticker said, Where are we going, and what am I doing in this handbasket? So people have a clue. They don't necessarily know the big picture, but they know the details of their own situation. It's why it's so hilarious, tragic in a way, but hilarious for people to hear the economists and the politicians talk about we might be sliding into a recession. For most people, you know, they've been down in that trough for a long time, and they're ready for serious change that focuses on grassroots, percolate up economics for a change.
But when Jim Hightower, Texas progressive populist, raises this change banner, you're not talking about tinkering at the edges. I mean, you've got a big critique. You go right at this essentially what is the heart of the American economy. You're pointing at the big corporate structure that almost all Americans live and work in and saying it's wrong, it's off track, tear it down. It can sound like not just a little rebellious, it can sound like an economic, uprising against the way life is today. What's your view?
Well, there is an uprising, and I don't say tear it down. I do say stop subsidizing it. stop giving all the tax breaks to the big guys, not only at the federal level, but at city levels as well. Stop undercutting the middle class in our country with NAFTA trade scams and that sort of thing, importing more workers from abroad, low-wage folks, to come in here and take our jobs. I'm not talking about immigrants from Mexico here. I'm talking about high-tech workers coming in.
But you're naming names. You're saying Walmart, McDonald's, Exxon, Safeway, Nike. Just go on down through the brands.
Right.
And you're saying these big companies, the ones that are described as being our kind of competitive face in the global economy, turn out to be the least desirable way for an economy, a country, to be organized.
And that's the point of my book, is that corporations would have you believe if you're anti-corporation, you are anti-business. Well, not at all. As George W. might say, I are one. I have a business. I come from a small business family. But there are different ways to organize business than the corporate structure, partnerships, cooperatives, single proprietorships, barter clubs. There are all kinds of ways to formulate it. And what folks don't realize is that, or the powers that be don't want us to realize, is that these can be much more satisfying ways of organizing your own business pursuit. And so I've tried to, Susan and I in this book, have tried to tell the stories of some of those folks out there who are doing it. You know, they say, well, you can't change the corporate structure. But as my friend John Dromgoole, he's a pioneer in organic gardening, has a business and all, he says, those who say it can't be done should not interrupt those who are doing it.
And yet you know what the response often is. You write it yourself in the book, sort of you're kind of writing the conservative critique, imagining it. And away we go, Hightower with another of your lefty hate America screeds. You know what your problem is, don't you, Jimbo? You're writing here. You're just anti-business. I mean, are you describing, we'll look at it, but are you talking about some kind of local organic economy that puts us all back in little mud huts? Can we really be global competitors with little local economy approaches toward life?
What we can be is cooperatives, single proprietorships, all sorts of small business formations that result in big economy. Those are the kind of people we've cited. For example, the Organic Valley family of farms. Many of your listeners will have bought their eggs and their butter and cream and stuff. It's a co-op that's organized beginning out of Wisconsin, but doing a multi-million-dollar business now that dare to try to practice democratic, little d democratic principles as a core of their business operation, to respect not merely the farmers who are in the co-op, but also the workers and the communities in which they operate. When they make a profit, they have a profit-sharing plan. 45% goes to the farmers, 45% to the workers, 10% goes to the communities. You don't find a lot of corporations organizing it like that.
You think this country is ready for that kind of big attitudinal, organizational shift?
Not only do I think it's ready, it's happening. People are doing it at the grassroots level, and it's beneath the radar of the money and the power establishment, but nonetheless, it's taking place. And certainly in the food economy, we've seen that. The fastest rise in food is the local food movement, the organic food, you know, whatever term you want to use for it.
We're going to hear the stories. Jim Hightower is with us. His new book is Swim Against the Current. He's got all kinds of advice in here. Question authority. That's a bumper sticker. It's also front and center in this book. Question their answers. Trust your values. Stand up for your beliefs. Take risks. Invite change. He's calling for a little American rebellion. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Texas rabble-rouser Jim Hightower about his call for Americans to stand up and get rowdy for a change. His new book is Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Who wants to be one of those? Jim, give us some stories here. You've got a bunch of them in the new book about the kind of moves and people and changes that you're championing here.
Well, among them, you know, first of all, Louis Grizzard, the late Southern humorist, used to say that the difference between being naked and being naked. Being naked means you don't have any clothes on. Being naked means you don't have any clothes on and you're up to something. So these people are up to something.
Okay.
I mean, they've got an idea. They have bucked the system and they've decided, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way to do it. An example is a pharmacist down in Texas. Name is Chris Johnson. Making $100,000 a year in a corporate drugstore.
Okay.
Doing well for himself, but he said, it made me sick to my stomach. And the it was that people would come up with their prescriptions, he'd fill them, present the bill, and they would back away and leave without their medicine. And as a corporate functionary, he had no authority to say, oh, come on, let's work something out.
They'd back away because they couldn't pay the freight.
They couldn't pay the bill. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so finally he made a break because it was just eating him up. And he opened a little store called Med Savers that focuses on people who have no insurance or their insurance policy doesn't cover prescriptions, and focuses on generic drugs primarily, and focuses on prescriptions. You can't buy a chainsaw in his drugstore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It is what it is. But he gets to know his customers. They know him. They trust him. He can sell, for example, a particular bottle of pills that would sell at the chain store for $59. He can sell for $16 because he doesn't deal with the insurance companies. He doesn't have the big overhead and the high salaries.
But he's still got to make a profit. He's still got to feed his own family at the end of the day. Walmart has said not long ago they were going to sell generic drugs at rock bottom prices. Can he really offer something that Walmart can't at their enormous scale?
Yes, personal relationship and actually overall cheaper prices, because Walmart said we're only going to offer that on certain drugs. You got to read the fine print when Walmart says something.
Mm-hmm.
And all of his prices are much lower. Yet, yes, he is making a profit because he said there's obscene profit built in to these drugs. He said he could even charge, instead of $16, he could charge $26 or something like that. But he said, I would then be getting into the same mentality of my corporate competitors, and I don't want to do that to myself or to my customers. I'm making a good living. He's reduced his hours to 10. His store's open 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. That way he can be home with his two boys for breakfast, get them to school. He can be there at night, put them to bed. He has a better life. And as he puts it, it's a matter of aligning your work with your values.
Okay, let's look at that. I mean, you've been in public policy. You were elected twice in Texas to Agriculture Commission. Can Can Chris Johnson's story, MedSaver, can it really be blown up to a kind of national scale and work for the whole country? Or are we talking here about, you know, a nice sort of boutique, moralistic effort in Austin, Texas that's going to be a, you know, a kind of Birkenstock one-off?
Yeah. Well, Chris Johnson doesn't wear Birkenstocks.
Okay.
and his customers don't wear Birkenstocks. These are regular people. Mm-hmm. And these stories are not anomalies. That's the point we make in the book. These are not exceptions to the rule. This is happening anywhere. We could have written this book in any town in America and filled every page of it with stories just in that location because there's more of this happening, again, than the powers that be want us to know.
Give us another.
They are competitive. Let's take cab driving. There's one.
Okay.
You know, that's a pretty rough job to have. You're out on the road sometimes, unsafe cars, bad weather. You got to compete against each other.
Mm-hmm.
It can be pretty rough. Well, cabbies in Wisconsin. Back in the 1970s, they were making 40 cents an hour, not money even back in those days. They were being treated by the owner with all the respect of a Kleenex, and finally they rebelled. First, they tried to unionize the cab company, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
But then the owner said, oh, the hell with it. You know, I'm not going to put up with the union, and he was going to shut the company down. And the cabbie said, instead of just, well, adios, they said, well, we can do this ourselves. After all, who's been doing the dispatching? Who's been driving the cabs? Who's been maintaining the cars? It's us. So
where are we talking here? Milwaukee, Madison?
Madison, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so over the years, it's a wonderful story. I'll cut it short. As they built a remarkable worker-owned and managed enterprise called the Madison Cab Cooperative. And now I learned about this because I was in Madison taking a cab to the airport, and the guy turned around and said, you know you're in a union cab. And I said, no, I had no idea. And he proceeded to tell me that he had been one of the organizers of this cooperative, and he had been able to put his kids through college driving a cab. I mean, not a lot of cabbies are in that situation. So now Union Cab today has revenues of $6 million, 200 employees, a wage above $28,000 a year, 63 taxis, 3 full-time mechanics, maintenance shops, fueling station, et cetera, and a customer satisfaction rating of above 90%. It's a success because they also maintain their democratic principles. Within that co-op, they get along with each other, and they make it work.
Jim Hightower is telling stories of change at a grassroots level and calling for them right across the country. He writes, asserting your own values, fairness, justice, equal opportunity, stewardship, democracy, and placing human aspiration above corporate avarice is as important and as historic a struggle as were the fights for human dignity in the 1960s and 70s and the labor struggles of the 1920s and 30s to better the lives of working people and old folks. And you think these little stories will add up, are adding up, as you put it, to a real challenge to the dominant economic structure in this country.
Well, it's already happening. These are little stories, but there are millions of these little stories across our country. And it's happening, for example, in the food economy, where you see small artisans, local farmers, markets, and public officials coming together, consumers coming together to change the food economy. They want local food, good food.
Yeah, a lot of people buying into that, but a lot of people pushing a big cart at a big supermarket.
Yes, they are, but that's beginning to change. Is the point. So much so that now the big guys are trying to get into it. Even Walmart wants to sell some organic food. They want to bring it from China, but nonetheless, I don't know about that. But the point is that organic food is now the fastest growing segment of the food economy, roughly 20% a year. It increases. And now the local food movement, trying to buy as much locally, not only in markets, but also in the school systems and in other possible.
The ones that aren't serving Downer beef.
Yes, we are right. Get your downer cow. And it has produced a remarkable change at the grassroots level and a better economy.
Jim Hightower's new book is Swim Against the Current. Jim, a lot of people want to talk with you. Let's go to them in Columbia, South Carolina. Marjorie is calling. Hi, Marjorie. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
And hello to Jim.
Hello.
I'm looking at my issue of the lowdown.
Ah.
And you have talked about, you are addressing the issue of having a real stimulus package, and I want you to speak to the issue of what we could do with that $720 million if it didn't go to the war. I'll listen online.
Thank you very much. And
thanks, Marjorie.
Speaking of my monthly
newsletter, Lowdown.
The Hightower Lowdown,
mm-hmm.
In which, yes, our current issue focuses on the $300 and $600 checks were all being mailed out to stimulate the economy, apparently not understanding that people would take those checks maybe down to Walmart and buy some goods, and then that will stimulate the Chinese economy very nicely, but not going to do much for our economy. So instead of that, why don't we have a program of rebuilding the infrastructure of America? It's just been an act of cowardice, in my view, of politicians of all stripes at all levels, that they have allowed our national house to fall into disrepair. Just on roads and bridges and other transportation systems, a recent report from the Civil Engineering Association said we're looking at $45 billion a year for 50 years. You know? So that would be a better way to spend that $700 million that she's talking about.
On roads and bridges and infrastructure, which would be jobs, but still at the end of that day, are those wages still going to be spent at Walmart? Does it matter?
Yes, it does matter. But people can make that choice. You know, again, what I'm talking about is to give people a choice, and these businesses are, that you don't have to go to Walmart. There's something in case of MedSavers, you can get a better price on your pills, have a relationship that is positive for you, and the money that you spend stays in your town rather than being hauled off to the billionaires in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Jim, let me get a call from Ella in Boston. Hi, Ella. You're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Hi, Jim. So many of us, when we're trying to make changes, just get burnt out and quit. I read your book from cover to cover in one sitting, and what stuck with me was your second section, where you stress that you can have fun while doing this.
Bingo. Yes. I believe, you know,
got to have what? Fun while doing it.
Absolutely. My credo is you can fight the gods and still have fun. And that is the other thing. In addition to the people that Susan and I write about in this book being people of rebellious spirit, the other thing that they have is a spirit of fun, enjoyment. They really throw themselves into these things. And particularly in the political section where we write about, I can tell you some stories about that in a minute. But that is so essential that we laugh from time to time. And I know you said sometimes you just want to quit, but that's what the powers that be want you to do, is quit. In fact, we've never achieved anything in the way of progressive reform in America except for long-term battles. You don't win the first time out. You don't win the second time out, usually. You just got to keep plugging. As my friend Willie Nelson puts it, the early bird might get the worm, but it's the second mouse that gets the cheese.
I don't want
to think about that, Tom.
We'll ponder that in the Zen position. Do you see that kind of high-spirited desire for change this time out that you're calling for, that Ella's wants to celebrate? Do you see it this time, or is it still dogged in the trenches?
No, it's definitely there. And my point is that the change that that the media and the political establishment is now trying to figure out, there it is, where do these people come from, is a reflection of the deeper drive for change that's been going on for several years in politics and business and all these other pursuits. So it, definitely this time it is, it's just, I mean, people are elated. I mentioned earlier by my caucus in Austin, Texas, that I went to, 400 people turning out. We had to go out in the parking lot. It was so big. And we divided up. Here was the Hillary table. Here was the Barack table. And we voted, and everybody just had a good time. They were laughing and hooting. We were, you know, giving each other the finger, you know, and that sort of thing, but all in a jousting kind of spirit. So people are upbeat.
Jim Hightower, always with that sense of humor, says Americans have got a great sense of humor. And if you don't believe it, look at what we elect to office. He says, got elected not once but twice in Texas. James is calling from Middlebury, Vermont. James, you're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Mr. Hightower, I'm an organic dairy farmer in Middlebury, Vermont. We were certified in 1987, milking 125 cows at a time when most people had never heard of organic milk.
Right.
I've just written a book about how to try to convince more Vermont dairy farmers to convert, because as you pointed out just a minute ago, organic is growing at the rate of 20 to 25% a year, and meanwhile, what we're paying for commodity milk goes down almost every year, or the costs go up, or both. So that Vermont, which had 4,500 dairy farmers after the Second World War, now has barely 1,000.
Right.
And I want to send this book to you if I could. I'm going to read your book, but I'd like to send my book to you. Would you be able to give me an address that I can send that to?
We'll give it to you off the air.
Yeah, James, we'll catch you off the air and get you someplace to get your book to Jim Hightower. And thanks very much for your call, James, in Middlebury.
Thanks also for doing that, but trying to show other people the way to it's not easy to break away. And that's why after each section in the book, we've listed extensive pages of connections so people can – everybody we've written about were willing to have their phone numbers and their websites and things put in to this book so they could help other people.
This kind of how-to and a network right here. It sounds like James in Middlebury may become part of it. Let's go to Merle in Newtonville, Massachusetts. Merle, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for bringing Jim Hightower to Boston.
Why not?
Jim, I've been reading the Hightower Lowdown for about 10 years.
Oh, how nice.
And reading it and then distributing it to all my non-political friends and trying to get them engaged.
Good for you.
I have a question for you that departs a little bit from the really very important topic of corporate control. It relates to something that you wrote just before the 2000 election or during that year. And it's about George Bush. I've never forgotten a piece you had about how when George Bush was a boy, an adolescent, I don't quite recall, he would put firecrackers into the mouths of frogs and blow them up. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, does the boy grow into the man? My question, though, is a serious question. I have consistently wondered why, with every major intelligence agency group in the world telling us that the kinds of evidence you get from torture is not reliable, why George Bush keeps putting his foot down and just a couple of days ago, once again, vetoed the bill because it would not include waterboarding as an appropriate means of getting intelligence. I have two questions. One is, maybe a silly question, which is there any connection between the boy and the man? And the second is, really, why do you think that this is happening?
Jim Hightower, Merle, thanks very much. Jim, what do you say?
Well, I don't know if there's a connection between the boy and the man, but there it is. He did do that firecracker stunt, and we've seen subsequent stunts that he has pulled.
Is that called pest control in Texas?
I think it is, out where he grew up. But, you know, Bush is a child of privilege who got where he is because rich people picked him up early and decided he was going to be theirs, and he surely has been.
But what if he believes that you've got to be ready to be tough to face a tough foe?
I'm sure he does believe that, and I believe you've got to be tough, but that doesn't mean you shred our Constitution, that you put our own troops at risk around the world, because now we've set a standard that they'll say, okay, we'll play by those rules as well. So our soldiers could be waterboarded. Our soldiers could be in that same situation. I mean, you've got to have some level-headedness to you, and a little bit of common sense, and Bush doesn't seem to be eaten up with much of that.
What's it going to be like for George Bush when he comes home to Texas, when he's really done with the White House? Is it the same culture that he left? Is he going to be embraced? He was elected and reelected governor before he came to Washington.
Well, he's going to have himself a very fine little library and think tank. It's hard to put the word think tank and George Bush together, but there is going to be. And they're not going to allow much thinking because they're already deciding to censor the number of documents, the kind of documents that will be available to scholars and to others.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Texas rabble-rouser Jim Hightower about his call for Americans to stand up and get rowdy for change at all kinds of levels, including right down at the grassroots. He talks about a lot of examples of that in his new book, Swim Against the Current. Susan's calling from Mount Sydney, Virginia. Susan, you're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Hi. I am a sole proprietor. I agree with your philosophy 200%. My question is our medical system fixable? I think there's a lot of people that would join the self-employment group if they didn't have to stay where they are for the benefits.
Very good point. Thank you, Susan.
Off the air.
Exactly. I think you know, that the biggest reform that we have got to deal with is the health care system in this country. We spend more than any other country per capita on health care and get, I think we rank 37th, just below Botswana or somewhere. But we could have a much better. So we have to have a universal health care system. It would make our own corporations even more competitive in the world, and more importantly, you're right, it would allow small business people as well as workers and farmers to be able to have a much stronger competitive position. Right now, it's a killer. I mean, I provide health coverage for my small operation, and it's a heavy hit, and she's right. A lot of people who want to go into business, they want to provide the health care. And they think, well, if I can't provide health care, then I really don't have a business plan. You
know? So let's get pointed here. You're clearly in the Democrat column. You've come out for Barack Obama. Do you believe that he's got the better health care plan? Or is Hillary right when she says he doesn't require everybody in, so it doesn't work as well as what she's proposing?
I don't believe either one of them had the best health care plan, but I think they've at least got bold plans. I think Hillary Clinton has the better health care plan. I'll certainly admit that. But I think that that Obama or Clinton, possibly even McCain, if they get in there, they're going to have to go to a universal health care proposal, some form of a single-payer system, not just adopting it from Canada, but some form of that, because it's the only thing that will work. It actually succeeds.
Why have you come down in the Obama camp? You think Clinton's got the better health care plan. That's a pretty big chunk of business. What's your calculus that left you at the end of the day on the Obama side of the ledger?
Each one's stronger in different areas. I think they're both amenable to changing their own positions, improving their own positions, I would say. And the reason I have come down for Obama is because I believe that not only would he go into the White House, but his supporters are so enthusiastic and so determined for changes in policy that they would go into the White House with him and be a countervailing force. He would not be in there alone. I've been in state government, and I've been under attack. Mm-hmm. For example, I was the pesticide regulator of the state of Texas as ag commissioner. The powers that be didn't like that, mm-hmm. the chemical lobby and mm-hmm. Farm Bureau and others. So they decided to try to move my pesticide authority to a safer agency. So they had a hearing, and they were going to just ram this thing through. Well, suddenly, day of the hearing, such a crowd showed up that they had to move it to the House chamber. And my leadoff witness was Willie Nelson. My second witness was Barbara Jordan. And my third witness was the chairwoman of the Dallas Republican Party, because Republicans don't like their babies having pesticides on their food. So my point there is, rather than fighting the inside fight where I would have lost, I was able to go to the outside and bring them inside. And that's what I think Obama can do. I think his forces will demand that.
And Senator Clinton seems to kind of poo-poo that, to say she's got the experience, she knows the inside battles, and that's the strength she can bring to the fight.
Well, we've seen some of what Bill Clinton did and through the inside, and it was not anything that I think she's bragging about these days, including NAFTA, including the welfare reform deform program, really, including Telecommunications Act and other actions that they took through the inside with the lobbyists. They did not let the outside in. And so I think she would be more inclined to in this presidency, but I think Obama gets that from the start. That is his goal. I think, Tom, we're in a 1932 moment. Roosevelt, when he campaigned, he didn't talk about the New Deal. We didn't have a New Deal. It's when he got in and all those people were there saying, we have to do something. And you had people like Sidney Hillman, other labor leaders. You had governors and mayors who had already been experimenting mm-hmm. with programs. And they put the New Deal together. He was the force that brought the outside in.
Do you think Geraldine Ferraro is right when she has said that Barack Obama would not be where he is today in this campaign if it were not for his race?
It's ridiculous. I think she needs to remain very as quiet as possible for the rest of the campaign. I mean, that makes her candidate look silly, and that's why I suppose that she resigned. Of course not. I mean, you know, we haven't had a lot of black presidents, you know, not a lot of black corporate leaders. I mean, that of course, is absurd on the face of it.
Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia, and Edie. Hi, Edie. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm a single mom of three, and I'm totally sold with what you guys are talking about. I just want to know how to put it into practice. It sounds fantastic, but what do I do in a daily life situation? How do I tell my friends, all right, here's what this guy's talking about. It's fantastic. Here's how we make it happen starting here at the grassroots.
Edie, you've got a tough line, but we'll pick it up. And sorry for the bad line there. Jim, single mother of three, captivated by your message, but asking how do you put it into practice in daily life? Dive in wherever you like.
You have to have help. You can't do it just by yourself, and that's why, people have pioneered, but the point is help is available. And I'll just give you an example in politics. There's a group called Wellstone Action out in Minnesota, named for Paul Wellstone, and they're doing campaign training. They train candidates, they train organizers, they train campaign managers, etc. And they come down to educating us how we can run for office as just regular people, and how we can organize at a grassroots level for everything from living wages to health care plans. And they understand that we have to help each other do that, that it doesn't come just automatically. There's a hardware store near my home in Austin, Texas, that you can buy a nail, Tom. You don't have to buy the whole package.
A single nail.
They'll work with you on how to design your project. They'll loan you a tool so you can go home and use it and bring it back. And their slogan is, "Together we can do it yourself." You know, and that's what these groups represent, hands-on group, and that's why we've listed so many of them at the end of each section of the book, so you can get hands-on help. You can have consultations with these people and say, I'd like to do this in business, I'd like to do this in politics or healthcare or religion or any other way.
Find a crew.
That's it, right.
Let's go to Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and Everett. Hi, Everett. You're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just had a question for Mr. Hightower as to whether or not which does he think will be more effective for us to make this change, whether it's going to be our vote at the ballot in politics or where we shop, who we give our money to, which does he think will be more effective, and take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Everett.
Thank you.
Jim?
Well, luckily, you live in America, and you don't have to make that choice. You can have it both. You've got to be active in the voting booth to change policies that let these flowers bloom across the country and that keep the corporate power from crushing those flowers, which often goes on. But also, you can do it with your purchases. Those are your dollars or your votes. But also, you can do it with your own instinct. Find ways to break loose in your own pursuits. Whether that's in business or any other activity.
Give us a political story from your bag of stories.
All right, let's take money in politics. Mm-hmm. The top issue in my mind in our political system is the corrupt money, primarily corporate money, that pours in at all levels of politics. This money doesn't just talk, it shouts, and it drowns out the voice of people. It is a form of bribery. Molly Ivins, we dedicated the book to Molly. Mm. She told a story of a state senator who came to Austin and first thing off, he encounters a lobbyist, says, I need your vote tomorrow on a bill. Here's $200. The senator says, oh, okay, pockets it and goes away. Next day, come the vote, he votes against the lobbyist bill. And the lobbyist grabs him and says, what in the world are you doing? The senator said, well, the other side offered me $400. And then the lobbyist exploded all over him saying, my God, don't you understand anything about ethics and integrity? And the senator drew himself up with all the dignity he had and said, well, you knew I was weak when I took the $200.
But
the issue is not the occasional bribe. The issue is that the system itself is now a bribe. And some say, well, there you go, Hightower, you can see you can't stop it. They plug loopholes into any reform. Well, tell that to the people up here in Maine, for example, where they've had public financing now for 8 years of their elections in that state, everything from state rep through the governorship. And the result is phenomenal. It means regular people can run for office again because you get access to a pool of money that makes you competitive even with the incumbent. The results are startling. Maine has now has 83% of its Senate and 84% of its House elected without taking a dime in corporate money for their elections. It's really changed the politics in that state. And you got people like Deb Simpson, we write about her. She was a single mom. working in a cafe up in Maine. If you're a wait person, you get half the minimum wage and then tips. Not exactly the kind of person you would say has got a bright political future.
Not necessarily.
Exactly. But because of public financing, she was able to run for the state legislature, and she won. And she's now in her fourth term. And it means that that legislature now has a whole different perspective in the committee hearings and on the floor of any debate on any issue, that they've never had a single mom wait person, you know, in there with the lawyers and with the bankers and with the lobby crowd. So it changes the debate.
Find a way in. Let's go to Kathy in Edinburgh, Virginia. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Jim. It's so great to hear a home voice, though. I've been in Virginia for 10 years, and I'm starting to miss Texas.
All right. We'll send you some barbecue.
Oh, would you? I'm telling you, North Carolina barbecue just doesn't matter.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Texas reunion. What do you say, Kathy?
Okay. First of all, since I came up here when Bush was still governor. It's like, get me out of Texas. And I ran up and down the streets going, but the governor of Texas has no power. Why do you expect him to be a good president? And nobody would listen to me.
You're right.
And then, you know, I'm saying, I've been spouting the same things that Mr. Hightower is, you know, writing about. I've been saying it over and over again, but we can't get through these thick people's heads.
Well, I think we are getting through.
I hope so.
Now, I mean, people are in rebellion, pretty much open rebellion. And by the way, to both political parties, people are mad at the Democratic leadership in the Congress because it has just gone along with Bush's, you know, the domestic spying program. Okay, well, it's illegal, but so we'll legalize it. I got an email, Tom, from a guy saying he hoped that Bush would get caught smoking marijuana because then Congress would legalize pot.
Sounds like an email from Molly Ivins, dearly departed.
All right, could have been down from heaven. But, you know, we just have to keep pushing, and that's my message. You know, again, it's perseverance is a big part of democracy. You don't go out in one blow and say, oh, I lost the election, I'm moving to Canada, you know. Well, that's not exactly – well, I tell you, I was up in Vermont at a political event, and a guy came up wearing a political button. It's the best one I ever saw. It said, wearing a button is not enough. You know, we've got to be a little more than button wearers in this country. We've got a history of people who, you know, didn't just inconvenience themselves. They fought, they bled, they died to make it possible for us to be this far along in our pursuit of egalitarianism.
Grab a pitchfork, says Jim Hightower. Let's get one more call here from Saranac Lake, New York, and Gail. Hi, Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to let Jim know about a couple of little flowers of revolution that are happening in a tiny little northern Adirondack village.
Very good.
Of 5,000. We had the threat of Walmart coming to town, and they were going to open a 121,000-square-foot super center here. And as a result, we managed to keep them out. But what we're trying to do is start a community-owned department store, which is kind of a revolutionary idea.
Very good.
The community buys shares and owns the store, and we can stock it with what we need and what the people want, and we don't have to listen to some corporate hierarchy. We're also working with local farmers to bring food from the farm into the village so that people can buy the things that the farmers have, and we don't have to support, you know, the imported, you know, food that comes from California, Peru, or, you know, so far away.
Gail, do you think you're ever going to become the norm, or is this always going to be at the margins, you know, way up in the bleachers looking on as Walmart and everybody plays on the big field?
I think that the country is shifting in a new direction, honestly. We're getting calls from all over the country about how to open a small community-owned store. I think that the tide is turning and that people are finally seeing that this is not the good thing for America. And that the small people, the local people, need to take care of their own. And I really think that's a revolution that's happening.
Gail, thanks very much for your call. Jim Hightower, you're right. And you know that Americans are often told that this is not really what they're about. That, you know, sort of we've got a system. It works. It's made the country very powerful. And it's made the country very rich, which it certainly has over many years. The Jim Hightower view is not what this country is about. Settle down, go with the flow. We've got the formula here. Don't let Hightower screw your head around.
Yeah, that's right. That's the message from the powers that be. But as Gail was just indicating, that people are, you know, we're disobedient. We're a disobedient people. And there comes a time in which people break from that norm and say, you know, I'm not going to obey that because it's not working for me and it's not working for my community. And I question whether it's working for America itself. So as Gail indicated, and she, that's a great example of up there in that little town in Adirondacks, yet another story. Again, these people are not exceptions. This is a spreading movement. It's organic in a way in that it has no direction. Nobody is in charge of it. You know, it's coming from, percolate up from the grassroots themselves. In fact, Tom, let me just mention to the listeners, I'd love to have her join this. We're having a storytelling contest on YouTube, and because we want to hear more of these stories, have people tell their own story why they think, you know, they or somebody they know is doing something that would be worthy to be and swim against the current, the version that they would write. So you can go to my website, jimhightower.com/storytelling, and you'll get instructions there of how to do it. But make a little video of your own tale, and we're going to have winners and prizes and fun.
A lot of stories in Jim Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current. We'll put up a link at our own website, onpointradio.org, as well. He quotes Patti Smith, the singer, in the book, "The people have the power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools." Well, we'll see. There's a big old arm wrestling match. We'll see where that one goes. Jim Hightower, it's always good hearing from you. We thank you for the new book, and thank you for being with us today. Thanks a lot for coming by. You and your big Stetson here on the studio table, too.
Been a pleasure. Thank you, Tom, for your show. Terrific.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.